Most of today's women resemble bower birds that force suitors to build elaborate nests of twigs, leaves, and discarded garbage before choosing a mate. Any male who doesn't meet their standards doesn't get to mate that year. One assumes he just stays in his bower reading bower manuals and watching bower bird porn. Hey, gals, not every guy is Ryan Gosling from The Notebook. Even worse is the seahorse. The man seahorse shoulders the burden of carrying baby seahorses to term. The seahorse is by far the most whipped animal and by far the most frequently sighted in my own marriage. Of course, you could also be the male octopus, who after a lovely evening of cephalopod merriment gently fills one of his arms with sperm before detaching said arm and watching it crawl into his life mate's mantle cavity. Oh, don't worry, he doesn't feel anything, because he's dead. Remember how he detached part of his body? It just proves that even under the sea, women will go to any length to limit a man's options. Hold on to those arms, fellas. I don't care if she has the ocean's most iridescent chromatophores. By far the most promiscuous animal is the bonobo, a species of chimp that will apparently swing on any vine. Girl on girl, guy on guy, something called penis fencing. All they're missing is a subclass of bonobo pornographers to roll tape so they can sell it to hard luck bower birds. Luckily, for every bonobo, there's a New Mexico whiptail lizard. Wondering why you've never heard of these from the Free Animals Willies crowd? Maybe it's because they don't have sex at all. They reproduce by parthenogenesis, the way God intended. It's got Genesis right there in the name. It's a travesty that these reptilian paragons of morality go sorely neglected as high school mascots, while sex fiends like hawks, cougars, and wildcats get stitched onto our daughters' sweaters. That's gotta rub off. So far, you've learned everything you always wanted to know about sex that I was willing to tell you. Except one thing. How to get it. In olden days, it was simple. You just accepted her along with a large amount of gold to cement the merger of your empires. But today, it can be so complicated. Listen to this tale out of my own past. The year? Yesteryear. The scene? A bowling alley. I was on my first date with Tricky Gluey. As a gentleman, I never pronounced the vowels in the names of my former conquests. Tricky was a dark-haired beauty I'd met the previous Sunday at a fraternity mixer. Back then, I was shy, and it'd take me all night to work up the courage to send a letter to her parents requesting their permission to take her out. Lucky for me, they had returned with the yes box checked. So here I was, watching my lovely date approach the lane with a determined stride. Now, needless to say, I crushed her, 134-62. Women respond to dominance, and when I got that 10th frame spare, I knew I had sealed the deal. Newsflash. I've had hundreds of girlfriends. Growing up, I lived in a strict household. All I knew of the opposite sex was what I read on my mom's shampoo bottles. Women cared about smelling terrific, and they liked to be made to feel soft, silky, and very shiny. While other kids started petting and going down to petting town as early as sophomore year, I was a late bloomer. But I don't regret it, because once I bloomed, I turned out to be just what women love, a sex flower. I'll admit it, I miss my swinging bachelor days. I used to have dating down to a science, but now that I've permanently and happily hung up my single guy's sombrero, I'm glad to share my trade secrets with the next generation. For the ladies, dating do's. First, some crucial advice. Be on your guard. You might be looking for a life partner, but your date's most likely looking for a disco partner. Being cautious lets a man know he'll have to put in some effort to make your acquaintance, and the right kind of guy will respect you for it. That said, show some cleavage. It lets a man know you're confident enough to show some cleavage. So put on something that makes you feel like he'll feel you're sexy, and get ready to have fun. If you go out to dinner, let him pay. You deserve it. Plus, offering to pay makes you look like you got money to burn. Before you know it, he'll be hitting you up for loans and asking to borrow your car. I've done it dozens of times. And during the meal, order something that will get his attention, like a side of bacon for dessert. I can't think of anything sexier. That covers the ladies. What about the fellas? Guys, real ladies want a real man. What's a real man? Well, I'm a real man, and there's nothing I can do about that, even though some people want me to apologize for it. Well, no go. I will continue treating a lady like a lady, even though it's enough to get you smacked with a lawsuit these days. My legal defense team has advised me not to say more about it than that. So, what is a real man again? A real man is someone who walks through life the way a pilot walks through an airplane, cool, calm, and checking out the sexy stews. No matter how tough the situation gets, a real man never lets on about the faulty landing gear. They'll find out soon enough. The point is, if you want to attract the ladies, there are a few things you need to know about being a man, and luckily for you, you've come to the right audiobook. How to Tie a Bow Tie. Let's face it, guys, ladies love a man who looks good, and part of this means dressing well. In my line of work, I'm in a tuxedo all the time. It's the Emmys one week, announcing a boxing match the next. But even if you're a garbage man or you work at MSNBC, you're going to want to know how to tie a bow tie. Clip-ons are for losers. Nothing ruins your special date night faster than having someone come up to you and say, "Can we get some more shrimp puffs?" So here's how you do it. Start with the left end a little longer than the right end. That's your left. Okay? If someone else is tying it on you, that's their right. If you're left-handed, you're on your own. Now, slip the short end under the long end. After that, slip the long end under the short end. Now, fold the short end into a bow shape, holding that against your neck, folding the long flap over the front of the tie, and that should create a little pocket in there. Push the rest of the tie through that. God damn it, that does not look right. Okay, take that part of the tie out. Pinch it. Okay, pinch it a little and feed it through right that little place. Yeah, that thing right there until that looks nice. And then smooth out the right side. Slip a finger into the left bow. Pull the left bow through the... Oh, great. It's all jumbled. Just try holding... Oh, this looks like shit. What am I... Okay, let's just start again. Okay. Okay, grab three layers on the right and gently pull... Let's move on. Okay. Bow ties are not necessary. Okay? Wear a long tie. A lot of guys do that with the tux now. All right. This is a delicate subject, but I think I have to touch on it. How to act in the men's locker room. This really doesn't have anything to do with dating, but hey, as a man, it's something you should know. The gym is a minefield of homo danger, so watch your eyes. I recommend focusing on the lockers themselves. Examine the metal ventilation grooves and how the latch engages with the lock. One misplaced look can lead to all sorts of unpleasant misunderstandings. We've all been there. One minute you're toweling off your shins, the next moment you're at a nightclub named the Gandhi Dancer, toweling off everybody else. All right, how to ask a woman out. 98% of the confusion in modern relationships starts right here. Be direct about your intentions, like this. "Good evening, girl's name here. Would you be interested in going on a date and potentially bearing my children and quitting your job to raise them?" They will appreciate your candor. Don't fall into the trap of saying something like, "Hey, how'd you like to hang out sometime?" Then the girl doesn't know if it's a date or not. One thing leads to another, and the next thing you know, you're living with a woman who might just be your friend. How to act on a first date. If you want your first date to lead to a second, follow these two simple rules. 1. Always order for the woman. She's wrapped up in food issues. A woman is afraid if she orders the entree, she's going to look like a pig. But if she only gets a salad, you'll think she's anorexic. Take the guilt and shame away from her. Plus, it lets her know who's going to be in charge in the bedroom. 2. Don't do all the talking. It's rude. Do 2/3 of the talking. That's why I keep a chess clock in my jacket pocket. Lower your expectations. A date does not have to be perfect. You're not going to the barber, for gosh sakes. So, are you about to meet the woman of your dreams? Probably not. So just think of each date as a love scrimmage to prepare you for the marriage playoffs. Nobody's keeping score. But for the record, I'm winning. Be a gentleman. Chivalry never goes out of style, guys. Open doors, pull out chairs, offer to undo your own belt. How to dance. No way around it, fellas. Women will judge your potential in the sack by how you acquit yourself on the dance floor. So, few simple rules. Never dance alone. If you must, hover dance around the perimeter of a group of women dancing together and wait for one to respond to your display. Okay? Try holding your arms akimbo. In the poor lighting of a dance club, this makes you appear larger. Now, if one of them does turn to you, apply your move. Okay? I do what I call the Colbert Shuffle. I shuffle to the left for 4 steps, Then shuffle back to the right for 4 steps. Adjust to tempo. The love of last resort. Of course, while you're beating the bushes for a mate, the answer might be to just shake the family tree. An attractive cousin might fall out. Now, Nation, I have always been pro-cousin marriage. It is a great way to keep the bloodline pure. My own family tree is not so much a tree as it is a circle. Kind of looks like a tree eating itself. And there's nothing wrong with that. Don't believe me? Let's ask God. He's got some hard and fast rules in this area. Let's see. Leviticus chapter 18, verse 12, thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy father's sister, blah, blah, blah. Thy mother's sister, blah, ugh. Thy father's brother, man, there were some sick Levites. Of thy daughter-in-law, fair enough. Of thy brother's wife, nope. Nothing about cousins. Fair game. And this is great news, because dating your cousin is only a few nucleotides away from dating yourself. I don't know about you, but I rarely get through the morning shave without wanting to ask myself out. Will I say yes? Who knows? I have yet to get up the courage. You can't hurry love, but you can certainly take a shortcut. Instead of paging through Match.com, try flipping through the family photo album. Did you know the U.S. is the only Western country with cousin marrying restrictions? Hey, Congress, stay out of our bedrooms, unless those bedrooms are filled with gay people. I hope the heroes out there heed my advice and find the love they deserve, because there are a lot of people who don't want men and women to get together. They'd rather see us in constant battle, a war between the sexes, where the battleground is sex itself. Case in point, Kegels. Now, if you're like me, when you hear the word Kegel, you immediately think of the German word for 10-pin bowling, or Kegeln. Well, the other day I was searching the internet for news on the latest standings in the professional Kegel League, and I got the shock of my life when this shocking page from the Mayo Clinic popped up. Kegel exercises. How to strengthen your pelvic floor muscles. Now, I'm not squeamish about the female, you know, plumbing, but I'm not about to go into detail about what this clinic is suggesting women do. Suffice it to say, they must want women to work out the muscles down there for a reason of their own. These strengthening exercises are called Kegels and are named for Dr. Arnold M. Kegel, M.D. Now, I've heard of some weird fetishes, but this guy must have been a real sicko. Now, the ladies who sign on and install a Bowflex in their privates say there are all sorts of benefits, including increased sexual pleasure for both partners. I'm not buying it. Hey, everybody loves a firm handshake, but who wants to buy a car from the salesman who crushes your hand in a death grip? The worst part is that their operation is covert. Any woman could be doing it at any time, any place. Look around you right now. Do you see a woman? Is she flexing? There is no legal way to know. What the hell are they training for? It ain't picking strawberries. And they got us where they want us. Might as well put a bear trap in a honey pot. So fellas, you've been warned. From here on out, every casual conquest has been turned into a deadly game of vaginal roulette. Wow. Vaginal roulette. That was a little racy. I'll admit I'm out of breath, and I'm sure some of you are. So let's take a cool shower in Matthew 5:29. If your eye, even if it is your good eye, causes you to lust, gouge it out and throw it away. All right, that's better. How about another Stephen Speaks for Me? Your soulmate.
Hey there. I'm your soulmate. The one person on this earth who's perfect for you in every way. Yes, I exist, and yes, everyone else you've been with is a pale substitute. We're meant to be together, but we've never met. You see, there are 6 billion people in the world, and you encounter at most about 1,000 people per day, so statistically our paths would cross only once every 16,500 years. If we're going to beat those odds, you need to work harder, because so far, you've done a spectacular job of messing this up. Remember when you bought that pack of gum and the clerk asked if you want a bag, but you were in a rush, so you said no? If you'd waited that extra 3 seconds, you would have missed the next train, making you late for the play, so they wouldn't have let you in the theater until the first scene was over, and I would have entered the lobby, also late, and we'd have got to talking. We probably would have just skipped the play and gotten coffee, and then, pow! 50 years of golden summers at the lake house. Another example. Remember when you signed up for a yoga class? You should have signed up for a pottery class. I was taking a pottery class. How hard is that to figure out? And don't just sign up for a pottery class next time, because I might have moved on to hip-hop cardio. I can't tell you exactly where I'll be, because if you're really my soulmate, you'll just know. Please just get it right. Last time I dealt with my disappointment by sleeping with the pottery instructor. I guess what I'm saying is, next time you think about going to the museum today instead of tomorrow when I'll be there, ask yourself, do you really want to spend the rest of your life alone? Are you going to take the bus, or are you going to walk? If you do walk, and it's raining, how are you going to see me under my umbrella unless I don't have one, and you share yours, or I share mine, and that's how we meet? So remember, never leave the house without an umbrella. Or with one. It's your choice. I think I explained pretty clearly what's at stake. Are you reading this at a bookstore? I'm right behind you. Turn around! Am I still there? God, you're a slow reader. Point is, hanging over every decision you make, however small, is the sword of our loneliness. I am out there. Find me. But please hurry. I know we're meant to be together for eternity, but I can't wait forever. Oh my God! I just ran into my pottery teacher. That's so random.
Chapter 7. Homosexuals. I am a gay American. I couldn't be gayer now that all the gays are on the run. Of course, I'm using gay the way our founding fathers intended, to mean happy, for it was stolen from them by gays, same way they stole their tights, wigs, and cod pieces. Nation, we're at war. We can't let the gays gain any more ground on our American language, which is why we're going to start taking their words. First word we reclaim, homosexual. From now on, it's going to mean what it should always have meant, heterosexual. Think about it. Homo means the same, and we're all born with the same sexual orientation, straight. Ask any baby. If you don't share my outrage about this, the homosexual agenda has already got you in its velvet grip. Want to know what the other hand is doing? Just use your imagination. You're probably picturing something pretty steamy, right? Maybe a filthy little scenario taking place in a bathroom stall of a TGI Fridays while your wife and kids unsuspectingly eat their chicken wings? And your little gay fantasy just proves my point. Every single one of us fights a daily battle to suppress the insurgency raging in our loins. It's a long, hard slog, and we've all had the urge to cut and run. But Americans are fighters. We didn't give up in World War II against the Germans just because Nazism felt good. The homosexual agenda is nothing more than appeasement. They are sexual Neville Chamberlains. And they want us to lay down our arms and pick up rainbow-colored white flags. But we cannot let them win our hearts and minds with their thighs and abs. We must crush them. Now, I've got nothing against gay people. I just don't like how they flaunt it. I'm perfectly fine with someone choosing to be gay, as long as he marries a woman and has kids like the rest of us. And if he has to flaunt it, there's a place for that. The privacy of his own home, which should be a jail cell. We all know that people in prison engage in homosexual acts, right? Which means that criminals are more likely to be homosexuals. So wouldn't it save a lot of tax dollars to simply throw all the gay people in prison? You know, cut out the middleman. What's the problem? I'll tell you what the problem is. These days, there are more and more positive gay role models. When did gays become people to look up to? What happened to the good old stereotype of the creepy guy sneaking back and forth from the bar with no windows to the movie theater that doesn't say what it's showing? Turn on the TV these days, and it's a virtual pride parade of admirable homosexuals. Ellen, Melissa Etheridge, Lance Bass. All the more respectable because they have the courtesy to identify themselves, unlike the surprise gays, or SGs as I call them. The SGs are celebrities that act manly and tough, then years later they come out of the pantry, and your friends start looking at you funny for having posters of them up in your weight room. All of a sudden, nobody wants to spot you. Examples of SGs are Mr. Sulu, Doogie Howser, and this one other famous guy who's about to gay surprise everybody. So how did this happen? Where did all these gays come from? Well, there are those who argue that some people are just born gay, but this is silly, because we are all made in God's image. So if someone were born gay, that would mean God is part gay, and he is definitely not. He is 100% hetero. God is all man, and I can prove it. Number one, God created man and woman, took one of Adam's ribs and made Eve. If God were gay, he would have turned Adam's rib into Dermot Mulroney. 2, he destroyed the city of Sodom. He didn't run a summer cottage there, he destroyed it. 3, he turned Moses' staff into a serpent. If he was gay, it'd be the other way around. 4, he turned water into wine. Not Appletinis, not Cosmos. God likes his booze straight and served from an animal skin. So I think we can put to bed this crazy idea that God is gay. Okay, I'm going to roust it for a second because I think it bears repeating. He's not gay. Okay, back to sleep idea. And he certainly doesn't believe in gay marriage. The institution of marriage is meant for a man and a woman. It's right there in the Bible, right after God tells everyone to stone the gays. Nowhere does God say he wants pairs of men to be fruitful and multiply. If that's what he'd wanted, he would have given gay men ovaries and breasts and luscious lips. But he only gave them the luscious lips. And yet, the biggest threat facing America today, next to socialized medicine, the Dyson vacuum cleaner, and the recumbent bicycle, is gay marriage. It's like the Redcoats, Greenpeace, and the Yellow Peril combined. I call it the Lavender Armageddon. And it is the biggest threat facing America today. Now, the man-huggers out there are saying, Mary, please, what about the Iraq War? Surely that's a bigger threat than gay marriage. Yes, Iraq is the central front in the war on terror, and we're fighting them over there, so we don't have to fight them over here. But consider this. Who, other than terrorists, wants to destroy our way of life? The gays. Allowing them to marry would be like strapping on a suicide vest with a matching cummerbund. When I married my wife, she became Mrs. Stephen Colbert. Likewise, I became Mr. Stephen Colbert. We went from being two autonomous individuals to a team whose sole function was to win the game of life. And by winning, of course, I mean procreation. And we have won. We have procreated. And I mean no disrespect to those listeners who have not had children. There is no shame in being a genetic dead end. Hey, dinosaurs are extinct and they're more popular than ever. Now, marriage involves a lot of sacrifice. For instance, my wife frowns on me having sex with anyone but her. If marriage is suddenly available to everyone, I'm not sure I want to make those sacrifices. I guess it's like that wise old joke. I don't want to belong to any club that would have gay people as a member. Now, one time, I believe it was 1952, acceptance of the gay lifestyle was so low that there were exactly 2 homosexuals in the continental United States. One was male, and one was female, so they never tried to get married. But today, tolerance is at a dangerous level, folks. And if it keeps increasing at current rates, everyone will gay marry, and our grandchildren's grandchildren may never be born. Or worse, they'll be gay adopted. And now another American who agrees with what I think. Austin, a formerly gay man.
My name is Austin, and I am a reformed homosexual. I was only 6 years old the first time I chose to pervert nature. I was with my mother at the bike store, and I decided to feel a thrill of excitement when I noticed a shiny purple Schwinn with plastic flowers on the basket. From that point on, I chose to feel different from the other boys in my class. Until the age of 12, I merely elected to feel a vague sense of not quite fitting in. But then, when puberty hit, I resolved to be alienated from and picked on by my male peers. I kept up this sinful pattern well into my 20s. I chose the urges that made my father stop talking to me. I selected the longings that led a group of morally stronger men to beat me up in a parking lot. I even picked the sense of contentment I felt during a 3-year live-in relationship with an older man. But all that time, I knew I was living against God's will. And so, I tried everything I could think of to turn straight. I changed the shape of my mustache. I went on dates with women. I even tried hormone therapy to raise my testosterone levels. And all this did was make me go fat and bald, which, in addition to my pale skin and short stature, turned me into what's known in the gay community as a garbanzo bean. In the lesbian circles, they're called chickpeas. Then, one day at hot yoga, I saw a flyer on the community board about a gay rehabilitation group called God Also Yearns. They teach that God desires us to accept the true path of love. I took the plunge and entered their proven 3-part program. Number 1, Accept the authority of your spiritual counselors. They not only condemned my wicked acts, but also sternly judged my clothing and income level. Number 2. Admit your sins. To purge them, I wrote them down. It became a very popular blog. Number 3. Submit to a higher power. This consisted mostly of electroshock. The God Also Yearns counselor said I could be completely cured if I attended their 4-week rehabilitation camp. At the camp, I joined in healing acts of Christian heterosexual fellowship, such as performing in the camp's traditional values version of rent, called Lent. I played Wally, the Republican senator who cast the deciding vote for the marriage protection amendment. I've never clogged with such passion. My God Also Yearns counselors taught me that homosexuality is an addiction like smoking, only you can still do it on an airplane. Today, I am married to a wonderful woman, Elfki. I don't hide my shameful past from her. During the physical act of love, I will often talk about it just to remind us both of how much better it is with a girl. I also call into a number of radio shows. I hope my story is inspiring to any homosexuals who bought this audiobook, not to listen to, but to carry as a signal to other homosexuals that they are willing to be approached and seduced. This book's distinctive cover will make it exceptionally good for that, but take it from me, there is another choice.
Chapter 8. Higher Education. If there's a bigger contributor to left-wing elitist brainwashing than colleges and universities, I'd like to see it. By the way, that's just an expression. Don't show it to me. You know, there's an old saying, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, which means a lot of knowledge must be a really dangerous thing, and it is. Look no further than the example of Ted Kaczynski, a.k.a. the Unabomber. He skipped sixth grade, got a bachelor's from Harvard, followed by a master's and then a Ph.D., and then embarked on a distinguished academic career of blowing people up. Most Ph.D. biographies have similar endings. Ted Kaczynski's last job before he went into full-time unabombing? Assistant professor of mathematics at the University of California, Berkeley, a.k.a. University of Blame America First, Berkeley. Yes, folks, he capped off all those years of being a student by becoming a professor. Let's face it, he'd have been crazy not to go crazy, which only proves my point. The greatest threat facing America today, outside of flag burning, yoga, and vaccination, is higher education. Just what makes colleges so dangerous? It's the fact that their classrooms and lecture halls are filled with a poison known as new ideas. New ideas hurt Americans in two ways. Let me ask you this. Why were you happier when you were a kid? Because you didn't know anything. The more you know, the sadder you get. Don't believe me? By the time you finish listening to this chapter, over 100 dogs and cats in animal shelters around the nation will have been euthanized. Bet you wish you could erase that knowledge. But it's too late. You learned a new idea, and it made you sad. College is just more of the same. Second, the physical cost. Pain is the body's way of telling the brain it's in trouble. Similarly, confusion is the brain's way of telling the body, all right, buddy, drop that book. Let's try a little experiment. Solve this equation. X equals negative b plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4ac over 2a. Okay, what you're feeling right now is your body rejecting an idea that is trying to make you learn it. Don't fight the confusion. That's just your mind scabbing over in a desperate attempt to protect you from that unnatural commingling of numbers and letters I just spouted. That's what new ideas feel like. For the record, Son of Sam killer David Berkowitz was a well-adjusted member of society until his neighbor's dog started filling his head with a bunch of new ideas. While it's true that you encounter new ideas in colleges and universities, colleges and universities aren't the real problem. Some of the college buildings are nice, and the lawns are quite lush. It's what infests these hives of higher learning that is the source of the real poison. I'm talking about academics. Not a day goes by without some news of a anti-American statement made by a lunatic in a mortarboard and elbow patches. By the way, here's a question. Elbow patches? Just what are these lecherous lecturers doing behind their lecterns that wears out their elbows so fast? I got 20-year-old suits and the elbows are pristine. So why can't we fire these edubaters? These men and all too frequently women who actually give credit for learning a foreign language. Because of a little thing called tenure. Well, I have a modest proposal for changing all that. Doctors don't get tenure. Plumbers don't get tenure. Can you imagine if baseball players got tenure and we had to sit there watching them round the bases in a wheelchair? I propose we do away with tenure on campus once and for all and replace it with a series of clear-cut requirements for professors, in no particular order except in this order. First, a cognitive skills test in which a prospective faculty member can demonstrate mental competence by memorizing a small passage of text, say a secret loyalty oath. Second, a test of U.S. history knowledge. Name the winner of the 1943 World Series. I got this idea from an old World War II movie about a squadron that had been infiltrated by a spy. I can't actually answer the question myself, but I'm not the one whose patriotism is in question here. Third, penmanship. Can the professor legibly write a brief paragraph? For instance, a secret loyalty oath. Fourth, eat a bug. Prove you love your country as much as contestants on Fear Factor. 5. Public speaking. Can the faculty member enunciate the secret loyalty oath when they are called upon to do so by a tribunal? 6. Good faith attempts at heterosexuality. Prospective professors would be required to produce evidence of at least 5 years' worth of heterosexual congress. Now, I'm open-minded. I don't say you must be straight to teach our youth. I only insist that you try. 7. Loyalty. If they fell into enemy hands, could the professor keep the loyalty oath secret, no matter what unspeakable act be visited upon them? Hint, it involves a glass rod and a hammer. 8. An essay on why Ayn Rand would thrash Shakespeare in a fair fight. This isn't a metaphor for the disparity in the receptions afforded their differing philosophies in today's left-leaning universities. Professors would be required to describe how she would kick his ass in a bar. Now, the easiest way for college professor bees to administer their idea poison is through their thought stingers, commonly called books. Think books aren't scary? Well, think about this. You can't spell book without boo. The only good book is the good book. Come on, the word good is right there in the title. And if there's one thing you can learn from the Bible, it's that books are responsible for the fall of man. Look at the story of Adam and Eve. Their lives were pretty great until they ate fruit from the tree of knowledge. Now, you don't have to be a biblical scholar to see that that fruit clearly represents a book. First, both come from a tree. Second, look, if my first point didn't convince you, I'm not going to waste my breath with another. Listen up. Ignorance isn't just bliss. It's paradise. Unfortunately, paradise is lost, and ignorance may no longer be an option. The sad truth is knowledge has become a racket. And these days, it's nearly impossible for the uneducated to break into the world of highly paid professionals. Doctors and lawyers, even some dentists, have to go to college. So to live in the gated communities to which you'd like to become accustomed, you gotta play ball. College ball. First off, if you're gonna squander your youth in the ivory jungle, at least shoot for the top schools. They provide something the best firms look for called cachet. Here's a rule of thumb. If a college is not in the first two pages of the U.S. News and World Report College Guide, all it offers is information and the possibility of drunken sex with your sweet mate, a dangerous potential that will gnaw at you for the rest of your life. The ultimate goal of going to a top school is the quiet satisfaction of whipping out your alma mater at opportune moments. At first blush, most people would peg me as an average Joe, and I'm proud of that. But my sheepskin announces to all assembled that though I may be a man of the people, I also have the keys to the clubhouse. I can't count the number of times I've heard the phrase, "You went to Dartmouth?" I find that hard to believe. Now the bad news. Admissions is an arbitrary and demoralizing process, and no matter how hard you work, the outcome is often determined by personal connections. You know what else is like that? Life. Also love tester machines. No way I'm a cold fish. Now for the good news. There is an entire industry in this country devoted to getting kids into college. And while you may not need Kaplan's or the Princeton Review to get into a decent school, you should pay for them anyway. We live in a capitalist society, love it or leave it. Applying to college teaches youngsters resume building, aka lying. Here's how it works. Let's say one day you're bored in class, so to pass the time, you make out with a Danish exchange student across the aisle. Now, on your college application, you can say that you carried out an independent study in foreign tongues. And remember, even the least padded resume can be overcome with a solid application essay. Here's the one that got me into Dartmouth. America is therefore the land of the future, where in ages that lie before us the burden of the world's history shall reveal itself, said the philosopher, scholar, and lover of thought, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. This tract reminds me of the egregious hardships and unwelcome adversity I faced last summer when I toiled laboriously on my grandfather's venison farm. It was my duty and task to deal the hinds a deadly coup de grace rifle blow at close range while they grazed luxuriously upon the surrounding foliage. Often I would summon the impoverished and penurious children who lived adjacent to my grandsire's acreage to assist me with my encumbrage, thus imparting to them the sublime significance of firearms. Receiving these pauperized youngsters unto my tutelage was the apex, pinnacle, acme, vertex, and zenith of my life's experience. In conclusion, my great-great-uncle was Daniel B. Fairweather of Fairweather Hall. There are two secrets that make this essay great. Secret number one, a thesaurus. Eggheads love the words. So the more you jam in there, the better. Think of it as a verb sausage. Secret number two, the last sentence. All it takes is a little research, and you can find the campus library, dormitory, or stadium that most plausibly could have been donated by your family. You'd be surprised how rarely these folks check into your background if you show up at the interview wearing an ascot. Congratulations! You got in. Feel good? It should. You were deemed worthy while your high school rival is going to his safety school. Now what? When you get to college, you're going to be on your own, maybe for the first time in your life. You'll soon learn that peer pressure is a terrible thing. You're going to be tempted to follow the crowd into a classroom. Fight it. College is good for only one thing. Can you guess what it is? I'll give you a hint. It starts with secret and ends with societies. Whether they be fraternities or eating clubs or, in Louisiana, parishes. Universities are the best places a young man can meet and bond with through an elaborate hazing process, those who will give him a leg up for the rest of his life. I cemented my lasting relationships with America's future movers and shakers by being forced to strip naked with half my fellow pledges and pass a Grease 45 record of foreigners hot-blooded from ass crack to ass crack. It could have been worse. The other half of the pledges were passing the greased turntable. Don't believe me? While most of his peers at Yale were writing essays about the tension between stasis and dynamism in Mariana and the Moated Grange, young George W. Bush was making the connections that would eventually lead him to becoming the most powerful man in the world. I speak, of course, of Skull and Bones, a shadowy organization that admits only the most deserving Yalesmen. Its members swear an oath of secrecy and use their wealth and access to power to promote one another once they graduate into the real world. For well over a century, Skull and Bones has provided a safe and brotherly environment where future Supreme Court justices, presidents, and captains of industry can gather to urinate on Geronimo's bones. Contrary to what you'll be taught in college, evolution is a farce. But Darwin did have one good idea, social Darwinism. You see, in the animal kingdom, God grants long life to whichever lion he thinks is prettiest. But in the world of human society, only the strongest, boldest, and worthiest individuals have the most sex, get the most power, and live the longest. College is the place to meet those people, and once you do, find out their darkest secret. It may come in handy someday. And now another Stephen Speaks for Me. Dr. Bernard Bruner, Ph.D., Distinguished Professor.
March the 13th, this 2007th year of what some may consider our Lord. I am Dr. Bernard Brunner, Distinguished Professor at a well-known and esteemed liberal arts university. Some may query, of what are you scholarly? Tragically, even I am not quite certain of that which is my endeavor. It ends in ology. I am certain only of this, that life is fleeting, and that much of my own has been wasted within the confines of small rooms and even smaller minds. I've spooled the thread of my life, arguing meaningless rhetorical questions with unformed, untried brains, and vainly pressing nimble young flesh into service. Oh, to feel the biting wind on my face! To wake in the early, still dark morn and milk a barn full of swelled cows! Or perhaps to live in the rough city, grasping steel work parts in my hard, calloused hands, the merit badge of the working man! But alack, harsh fate has decreed that none of these paths will be mine, for I have tenure, and she is far too comforting a mistress to loose me from her grasp for long. I lay in her arms and suck from her teat, fat and oily, and here I shall sit. And like a sneaky merman singing on the rocks, I try to lure young sailors away from the charted waters to a harsh and certain doom. Plug your ears, and though you be young, be wise. Listen not to me, and distrust me upon first sight. I will trap you in learnings of the past. Look to the future. Away, good sea! You must live to learn. Pray, live, whilst I, like all unnecessary things, do but shrivel, dry out, and turn to dust. With the most sincere of wishes, Dr. Bernard Brunner, Ph.D.
Chapter 9. Hollywood. Nothing can match the exhilaration of settling into your seat in a dark movie theater heady with anticipation. The screen lights up. Finally, there it is, the first pre-trailer advertisement. Will the hero be able to dodge the myriad obstacles on his way to the Pepsi machine? Will the girl next door fall for the arrogant pretty boy with the substandard wireless service, or the lovable goof with America's most reliable network, Verizon? That's what they call the magic of the big screen. Bravo, gentlemen. Then the feature starts and the evening quickly turns sour. Within minutes, you find yourself ushering your children out the exit while you desperately try to explain to them that God is not black. I don't understand movies today. They romanticize the liberal lifestyle, cram gays into our living rooms, and make children believe it is safe to spend time with Robin Williams. Let's face it. Next to hybrid vehicles, anchor babies, and heirloom tomatoes, there is nothing in America quite as corrosive as our so-called entertainment industry. This chapter isn't going to transport you to a glamorous world of magic where wishes come true and even sociopaths like Jason Bateman can become the slam-dunking lupine beasts of their dreams. No, this is a runaway train to cold, hard realityville. First stop, the good old days. Because while there's nothing more anti-American than Hollywood today, there was nothing more all-American than Hollywood yesterday. That's right, folks. There was once a golden age of Hollywood. It was so called because the original studio heads were the children of gold prospectors who settled in California, struck it rich, and then converted to Judaism. Back then, movies worked, whether they were talkies, soundies, or the short-lived loudies. The films of the Golden Age had one thing in common that made them timeless classics: corporate hegemony. From the crank on the cameras to the film's shipping canisters to the dusty hat on the wrinkled old usher with the air of defeat, the Big Five studios owned every dimension of movie making. They even owned the stars. Studios would pluck promising young actors from obscurity, then with a simple name change and an ironclad lifetime contract larded with morality clauses, turn them into Hollywood legends. Actors like Joan Crawford, born Sprinzel Anatevkowitz, and Cary Grant, born Balgok Uth, Devourer of Souls, got more than just starring roles in the hit movies of their day. They got firm moral guidance. Women could not appear in public without their makeup. Homosexual men could not appear without their beards, and beardless heterosexual men could not appear without their mustaches. As you can see, for a while, everything was dandy-dory in the City of Angels. But guess who shows up to crash the party and ruin it? You guessed it, the Supreme Court. May 4, 1948. The Supreme Court ruled the Big Five studios had violated U.S. antitrust laws and set off a process that led to their dissolution. 10 days later, the State of Israel was proclaimed. Coincidence? I believe so. Once again, the old adage proved true. The Supreme Court hates America. Suddenly, it was no longer okay for studios to force their female leads to take diet pills or copulate with rams. And talk about hypocrisy. In 1952, the Supreme Court made another ruling. This time, it was that movies were protected by the First Amendment. That's right, just 4 years after they criminalized Hollywood's free market, they upheld Hollywood's free speech. Which is it, Supreme Court? Are free things good or bad? Tragically, the 1952 First Amendment decision all but killed off the production code, the industry's guidelines for keeping movies moral. It was like the Bill of Rights, only for movies, and instead of saying what you could do, it said what you couldn't. The Motion Picture Production Code of 1930, often called the Hays Code, because that's what it forbade on-screen couples from rolling in, was a strict set of guidelines meant to ensure that motion pictures set a positive example. It was created to curb the corrupting influences of movies like The Bathing Cuties of 28 and Gangbang Dames of 29. The code took effect on March 31, 1930, 5 months too late to prevent the Wall Street crash, but early enough to keep the 60s from happening until approximately 1964. The Hays Code is gone now, but a look back at some of its clauses shows how much we've lost. Here's a sampling of some Hays Code rules. A man and a woman must never be shown lying in the same bed unless it has been previously established that one of them is dead. If a character places a folded towel over a second character's eyes and then invites him to do a sit-up, well, a third character removes his pants and squats in such a manner that the sit-up will bring the second character's nose into contact with the third character's naked nether sphincter, this action must be followed by a fourth character, preferably a member of the clergy, expressing disapproval. Should it be necessary to the story for a character to burp, sneeze, and pass gas at the same time, the action must result in death. If the story calls for an animal character such as Lassie or Rin Tin Tin to save a child's life, the reward may not be a free ride on Timmy's leg. For Christ's sake, somebody put a bra on Jean Harlow. But by 1968, the production code was no more. But sorry, Supreme Court, its death wasn't excessive, lustful, or perverted. Quick word here on censorship. The creative class says it's unconstitutional. But I advocate censorship. It's my First Amendment right to do so. They want you to believe censorship hinders creativity. Hogwash. Just the opposite. Take foul language. It's easy for a lazy screenwriter to put the words, "Fuck you, cocksucker," into a character's mouth. But the artist who translates that phrase for an airing on primetime television or a transcontinental flight is forced to come up with the much more interesting, "Flip you, cod bucket." I ask you, which is more creative? Luckily, the golden age of Hollywood was followed by an even goldener age, the age of the blacklist. Patriotic Americans secretly denounced Hollywood's most dangerous fellow travelers to America's House Un-American Activities Committee, led by American hero Joe McCarthy. America. One of my greatest regrets is that I never got the opportunity to name names, and I would have named enough names to fill the Moscow phone book, folks. Luckily, I do have the opportunity to rename names, which I do whenever I'm feeling exceptionally patriotic. Of course, most of the charges against these comrades of the cinema never added up to anything more than whispers and innuendo, but in Hollywood, whispers and innuendo are accepted as truth. If you don't believe me, ask Richard Gere's gerbil. Unfortunately, like any great era, the glorious days of the blacklist had to end. But instead of spawning a new goldenest age, Hollywood handed the keys to the kingdom to a generation of director rebels fresh from film school. Once again, higher education took a perfectly decent slice of Americana, threw it to the ground, and had its way. Your Scorsese's, your Coppola's, and a few non-Italian directors turned Hollywood on its ear in the name of a gritty, realistic style of filmmaking. Movies, once fantastic dreamscapes where cowboys fought Indians and gay men kissed Elizabeth Taylor, became squalid nightmares where cowboys turned tricks and hillbillies kissed Ned Beatty. These new Frank Crapras wanted to be important. To regular folks like you and me, important is remembering to tip before tax and not put tinfoil in the microwave. To Hollywood, important means picking an issue no one cares about and making it a movie. Well, guess what? The Golden Age movies tackled their fair share of difficult issues. I can think of several memorable films that tackled the difficult issue of how to get a large number of women to fall into a pool like dominoes. Just because these days a few Hollywood elites decide some issue is important enough to make a movie out of, why do I have to suffer through Syriana? Hey, George Looney, last time I checked, it was called Syria. Oh, by the way, Brad Pitt's way better looking than you are. I say if Hollywood absolutely must make a message movie, make one like Starship Troopers. It was the perfect political allegory because I didn't get it. People tell me it was about something, but all I know is that good guy army guy shot bad guy monster bugs with lasers in space. 4 stars. There's another dark side to Hollywood. It's not just the shattered dreams or the cheap porn or the moderately priced porn. There's something much worse. They're called Hollywood liberals. That shining city that only cares about money has an underbelly that only cares about saving the world. It's getting so America can't ignore the tiniest humanitarian crisis without some big movie star going on Access Hollywood to bitch about it. I guess the Motion Picture Academy mails out a pet cause with every Oscar nomination, because no sooner do we inform a star that we like him, her, that they're up on some soapbox. You know who I'm talking about. The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Sean Penn, Barbara Streisand, Tim Robbins, and Kirsten Dunst. These four are constantly whining about injustice, chaining themselves to redwoods, bad-mouthing our president, and tormenting us with their portrayals of the perfect yet unattainable hometown girl. Somewhere along the line, these A-list a-holes confused box office with running for office. Hey, celebrities, just because 20 million people went to see your movie doesn't mean 20 million people care about your opinions. Your job is to distract us from the horrors of the world, not call attention to them. We just want to be entertained. We want you to make us laugh or cry or worry if two cheerleaders from such different backgrounds can ever bridge their differences. That's it. And you know what? Cut it out with the fundraisers already. Who's getting all that cash? Refugees? Rainforests? Harp seals? Look, if a harp seal needs money that badly, it should do what I do. I hold a little fundraiser every day. It's called Going to Work. Without it, I'd be a charity case. Maybe they should give it a shot. Check the want ads. There are plenty of them out there. And don't give me harp seals can't survive in an office habitat, because that excuse doesn't hold water anymore, thanks to the Americans with Disabilities Act. You Hollywood liberal elites need to realize you wouldn't be famous at all if it weren't for Middle America, so stop trying to use your fascinating portrayals of Marie Antoinette to turn red states blue. You have a choice. You don't have to support America. It's a free country. But if you're not going to stand up for this land of ours, at least be consumed by some inner demons, snort glue, make a sex tape. Spiral out of control in a headline-grabbing way until you're wandering toothless through Malibu backyards or telling Larry King you speak in a musical bird-like tongue to the alien beings that visit you at night in the form of vibrating bands of color on your bedroom wall. This is very entertaining while also being a cautionary tale for our children. So now that you know what's wrong with Hollywood, let me ask you a question. If someone screwed off the top of your head, scooped out your brain, and filled your skull with garbage, would you fight back? You bet your screw-top head you would. This is a war, my friends, a culture war, and it is time to strike back. Unlike Paul Newman, who seems to think that salad dressing is a cure-all for America's ills, I'm a man of action. Here are a few simple steps you can take to end the stranglehold that the entertainment industry has on our need for being entertained. Boycott. Cut them off from your money, but just as importantly, cut their message off from your eyeballs. Immediately stop consuming all entertainment. This means TV, radio, movies, music, video games, magazines, newspapers, books, cell phone ringtones, the backs of cereal boxes, Bazooka Joe rappers.